Would you take out your copies of God's Word and turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 4? There are certain passages, at least certain passages that I go to that I depend on. There are certain books, certain authors, even some websites, some blog posts, some things like that, that at least in my mind, I have categorized under the tag of emergency. And they are the things that I read, and in every case that I reread, when there's a soul emergency. There's some sort of difficulty, affliction, challenge, disappointment, struggle that I need some help with. And this is one of those passages that we're going to look at tonight. I don't remember ever singing one of the verses from that Christmas carol, but the one about the weight crushing, stooping low. I didn't memorize it yet. Maybe I should. Maybe that can become a new emergency Christmas carol that I sing when necessary. But that's really good. And maybe my circle of friends is too small. Maybe I need to get onto Facebook and I would feel different about this. But almost everybody that I am talking to, hearing from on any sort of more significant level over the last couple of weeks, seems to be in a fight for joy. Not everybody is at the same degree of being pummeled out of joy, but lots of people, difficult, struggling. I was talking with Jonathan this past week. I mean, even the weather is doing its job to push you over the darkness and the cold. And winter is a season of death. So, look around tomorrow at noon when it finally the sun is visible, and you will see, the trees, they have lost their life signs. Those have all fallen onto your yard, and in some cases still need to be picked up like they do at mine. All of the death, like leprosy, has fallen off and needs to be cleaned up. And all of that to say, this is a passage that is one of those emergency type passages in my own heart. And hopefully, whether or not you've heard me talk through it before or not, hopefully it will be encouraging in an important way for everyone's soul tonight. Christian life and ministry, and even the main points, we'll start off with the word ministry. It's not necessarily limited to ministry. The reason why I'm even putting it in ministry terms is because 2 Corinthians chapter 4 so far has been about ministry, starting with chapter 4, verse 1. We've received this ministry by the mercies of God. We don't lose heart in this work. And then the subsequent paragraphs, Paul is talking about his work as a clay pot, holding this treasure as in a jar of clay. And the breaking points that he was brought to over and over and over again, even the point of death, where he says, death is at work in us, but life in you. And it's not just a professional or vocational ministry that is the concern in chapter 4. It's all of those who desire to see life come about in other people who then need to be dying themselves. All of those people who know those who are blinded. The God of this world has blinded your friends, your family, to the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ. And you wish, you want, you hope that they would see. That they would see the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. That's all in the beginning parts of chapter 4. So this last paragraph, that's why I'm starting out with Christian life and ministry are hard. And from Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, God said it's going to be that way. He's the one who put enmity between the seed of the woman and the serpent. And the decisiveness of who wins that battle has been determined, but we're still in the midst of it. Light and darkness are still at work, and saints have it hard because we walk in light while the world is in darkness. Disciples of Jesus are the ones who are called to serve and to give their lives while we live in a world that expects to be served and have other people give life so that we can have a better one. Believers embrace suffering while the world distracts itself, distances itself, however it can get away from suffering, it desires to do that. We, Christians, those who are involved in one another's lives, have some things that are hard, and what we need is to live on unseen things. And in a very industrial, technological, medically advanced, educationally superior culture, living on unseen things seems like bizarro world. Seems like exactly the opposite of what we see, literally, around us. Everyone is depending on the things that they can see, that they can touch. A person living on seen things looks like they're standing upright, while the person who lives on unseen things sort of appears as if they're walking around on their head, seeing things upside down, seeing things from a different angle than anybody else. One illustration I've used before for people who are living on unseen things is they're riding, imagine a horse, they're riding the horse blindly. Or maybe even more accurately, they're riding backwards. We're riding through this world in a backwards way, living on unseen things, facing the wrong direction, focusing on, according to other people, the wrong things at the wrong times. It is hard to stay the narrow course as Christians. It's hard to live on unseen things. We face others who don't understand what we're doing, some who oppose what we're doing, criticize and slander what we're doing, and that's just in general. I'm not thinking of anything specific there, but there's lots of specific applications. One of the people I think who is helpful in this kind of discussion is a man named John Bunyan. And even the message tonight comes from an extended series on living on unseen things and some discussion on John Bunyan. You're going to hear me use the word pilgrims multiple times tonight, and that's not me channeling John Wayne, that's me channeling John Bunyan. And I'm going to give some quotes from various of his works tonight that help us even with 2 Corinthians 4. John Bunyan, author of Pilgrim's Progress, a 17th century Puritan, lived and wrote about the Christian life, the Pilgrim's Progress, about the dangers and difficulties of traveling to the better country, to the celestial city, the Christian's final home. And he wrote for Christian pilgrims as one himself, enduring slander, imprisonment, all sorts of trouble himself on his journey. And as he sought strength, maybe he didn't call it an emergency passage, but it fits with his own pursuit. He regularly kept coming back to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, 16 through 18, it's the final paragraph of 4 in the chapter. Let's read the whole thing and then we'll look at the particular points. Verse 16, so we do not lose heart, though our outer nature is wasting away, our inner nature is being renewed day by day, for this slight momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. Three primary points for tonight, starting with our ministry confidence. We don't need to lose our perspective. We don't need to despair, no matter how hard it gets, no matter how pummeled our clay pot becomes. So we do not lose heart. That sentence that starts the final paragraph is the exact same sentence that began the first paragraph of chapter 4. We do not lose heart. And the repetition should pique our attention like before and after pictures, because some significant things have been talked about between verse 1 and now verse 16. It's sort of a bookend on the chapter, this not losing heart idea. It bookends, in particular, the Apostle Paul talking about his life and work, which was often hard, and at least at times appeared ineffective, unfruitful, and often afflicted. If you look back in verse 5, Paul talks about how he regularly slaved for others. We consider ourselves slaves, servants, your servants. He endured difficulties to bring grace to others, verses 7 through 10, verse 15. Even died to bring life to others, verses 10 through 12. As I said a couple times, he considered himself a weak clay pot. And when we feel like that, there's good reason, because that's what we are. It's what he's made us to be, carrying treasure, but we're not ever the treasure ourselves. Suffering for and speaking about the truth of the Lord Jesus. That's what we do. That's hard in a world that is at enmity with him, that are filled with enemies. They don't like him. They don't want anything to do with him. So Paul says in that work, he was afflicted, perplexed, persecuted, and struck down. He was thumped, thrashed around, worn out in his work for the Lord, and through all of it, he maintained this confidence in saying, we do not lose heart. The more positive way to say that would be, he kept his heart. That's really, like, I want that. I want to be one whose heart is kept, not lost. Not in a salvific way, but in a joy and ongoing, enduring sort of way. Though threatened, he couldn't be defeated. Tempted to wander, he wouldn't go AWOL. He was not completely crushed or driven to despair or forsaken or destroyed. He was brought up to the breaking point of all those, but he was never finally pushed over the edge. His daily dying brought grace and life to others, and he wasn't going to stop. And that plural, we do not lose heart, I think wraps into it every ministering pot in a similar sort of circumstance. If that's you, then this is a key paragraph on how not to lose heart, how he could have such ministry confidence. In the first paragraph, verses 1 through 6, Paul explained that we don't lose heart because our ministry is driven by the Spirit and it's a privileged calling. In this paragraph, he's got to double underline the promises that keep us on course. So there's ministry confidence. We do not lose heart. Secondly, in the second part of verse 16, though, is a concession. He admits, he acknowledges that not everything is as peachy rosy, vases full of blooming flowers as it could be. There are great promises that give us confidence, but it doesn't always look, at least on the outside, as if things are okay. He says, though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. He concedes, he acknowledges that his best life was not now, contra Joel Osteen. His best life was not now. His outer man was wasting away. He yields the point. He's not arguing that. He's not saying that everything was getting better. The outer self, the exterior, the part of us that can be seen, gets worn out and gets sick and gets hurt. It has trouble. I don't think Paul is referring to the old man of the flesh, though the outer man is connected to the body and struggles of life. I think he's recalling some of the earlier descriptions in chapter 4, like jars of clay, even then in verse 11 where he refers to the mortal flesh. There is an outer man to us. We're wasting away. New American Standard translates it as decaying. The New King James translates it as perishing. We are born to die. As soon as you take your first breath, you are preparing for the last one. Like, all along the way, we are wasting away. There are times, seasons at least, where there's more health than not. But this word, this wasting away, could be described sort of like the corrosive effects of rust. And it gets attached and then starts eating away and growing in its ugliness and its work to destroy. This is the aging, decaying, draining process that is always at work. Even when we sleep, we're resting the decaying outer man. We're giving him a break during that period of time from wearing out even more quickly. Wasting away isn't necessarily an enemy who is trying to assassinate us or to kill us. It's just that our bodies and physical lives are being ruined. And like, there's no need to deny that. Paul wasn't saying we don't lose heart because we are Arnold Schwarzenegger in his prime and nobody can touch us. Christian pilgrims concede that it's hard. For the pilgrim, though, the one who has the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ in his heart, the ruin of the outer man, this is the good part, that's not the only process that's at work in us. That's the one we tend to focus on. Even as Christians, it's easy to focus on that outer man's decaying, but that's not the only thing that's happening to us. The inner man is being renewed day by day. And, you know, for some people who have constant doctor's appointments and they count their pills by dozens rather than in single digits, it can be difficult. But for Christians, the inner man, the soul of man, the man's spirit, as we talked about this morning, is being renewed. And that renewal is as constant as the sunrise. Day by day, the inner man is being renewed. The resurrection of Jesus fuels every believer's inner engine. And there's no end to that fuel. It's a hidden, but still strengthening, invisible suffering. So a pilgrim's life is hard. The pilgrim's Lord takes care of the most important thing, his eternal spirit. But even our concession about the reality of these afflictions can't cause us to lose heart. That's how he started. So we don't lose heart. Even though the outer man is wasting away, the inner man is being renewed day by day. Now there's more to say about that, which is in verses 17 and 18, which gives us some behind the scenes or some explanation for how this renewal process keeps working in us day by day. God operates. This is why we need faith. God operates. He is working in us day by day, even when we can't necessarily sense it, feel it, or identify it. We must believe it. He is working in behind the scenes ways, whether we see it or know it or not. There are principles at work in the universe, principles that the Creator established that show afflictions and hardships even in this life lead to something better for those who are His children. And there's three considerations about our afflictions specifically, the things that challenge and weigh and hurt. Three things we need to know, three considerations about these afflictions. First is the nature of the afflictions in the first part of verse 17. The essence or the attributes of difficulties. They are light and momentary. First part of verse 17. For this light momentary affliction. I think at least I have one ESV that has light, and then there are other ESVs that have slight. I think light is a better translation than slight. Slight is meant to kind of refer to the piece of thing that is light. The slight widget is lighter than a heavier one, so to speak. There's no doubt that Christians encounter these afflictions. Paul has chronicled his afflictions throughout chapter 4. He just conceded that the outer man is wasting away, but these afflictions can only do so much. The momentary lightness of afflictions. Could translate it that way as well. The primary focus is on light, and that's not visible, illuminating light. This is a weight measure. It's light. It's not heavy. Now, we normally feel light when we're not afflicted. I mean, that's our common experience. We're happy-go-lucky. You don't think about those people as being afflicted. The afflicted people, and we Christians do good monk impersonations where, you know, afflictions bring with them a nice big brown hoodie and head down and chanting about how miserable we are while beating ourselves with the Bible. And that is not the Christian attitude about afflictions, at least according to this perspective. We speak about how difficulties weigh on us. We're burdened down, but Paul claims that they are light. How can he possibly say that? Well, afflictions are not slight as in insignificant or inconsiderable. Paul is not trying to say that whatever is hurting or harming or heavy feeling to you doesn't matter. He's saying that they are light in comparison to something else. And the image he's using is one of those scales where there's the tipping point and you've got your objects on both sides. The afflictions we have are light and momentary compared to something else. Now, like I said, this doesn't mean that afflictions are recess. Because if afflictions were recess, they would not want to go to recess. Or we would, like, there's definitions to words for a reason. So afflictions are afflictions because they hurt. Hardships are hardships because they're hard. They do challenge us. They do cause us to waste away, at least in the outer man. This isn't a game. It's not semantics. There are times when we feel like we can't take any more and the burden is too heavy. The point is that the pilgrim's heavy and hard way is light and easy when put on the balance with the glory we will receive later. So, on the light side of the scale are the light and momentary afflictions, and on the heavy side of the scale is the glory. The eternal, not temporary. The heavy, not light, glory that we will receive. The best that our afflictions can do. I don't necessarily recommend talking smack to your afflictions for any number of reasons. But the best that your afflictions can do is make your life miserable for some consecutive moments. That's it. They cannot last. Now, consecutive moments that fill up 70 years, totally, right, from our perspective, seems like a really long period of time. But compared to eternity, they are just consecutive moments that won't even really register if you could draw an eternal timeline. 70 years of horrific pain and trouble and sickness and slander is nothing in comparison. It's momentary and it's light. No clock or calendar can quantify the infinite duration of our coming experience. Afflictions for the pilgrim are light and momentary. That's their nature. That's why this is an emergency passage, because they don't feel like they're light and they don't feel like they're momentary. What we need to do is remember the coming glory. That leads to the effect of afflictions, our second consideration, that afflictions are not useless or vain. Afflictions are working on our behalf. Afflictions are our employees. And maybe you'd like to fire them, but they're working on our behalf. This light momentary affliction, second part of verse 17, this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. Present trouble is preparing us for an inexhaustible future of joy. Inexhaustible, uncontainable. The infinite and external glory is real. We can't see it now, but it exists. Not only is it real, it's almost unbelievable. It's sort of an exaggeration. When Paul says it is far beyond all comparison, that's the ESV. King James says far more exceeding. NIV says a glory that far outweighs them all. The Greek word is hyperbolein, from which we get our English word hyperbole. I know this is bad, but it helps with the word picture. The eternal weight of glory is so far out there, it takes hyperbole, exaggeration in our minds just to start to try to grasp how big and great it is. It's beyond all comparison. It is unbelievable, except to those who believe, those who have faith. It means to take something to an extraordinary degree. We could translate verse 17, the glory is according to hyperbole unto hyperbole. It's one hyperbole leaped on, put on to another. Tenfold. Take your hyperbole and add some hyperbole and then keep doing that. And that's the glory. That is our coming experience. One commentator said this, you may pass from one degree to another, from one sublime height to another, but still an infinity remains beyond. Nothing can describe the uppermost height of that glory. Nothing can express its infinitude. And this is by way of footnote application. It's why the 1 minute a day Bible study just doesn't get the job done, because it doesn't give us enough time in 60 seconds to think about infinity, think about the uppermost heights of glory, and then go on from there. When it comes to the emergency of the difficulty, we need to spend more time meditating on the glory that's coming and how inexhaustible and uncontainable it really is. Now, how are afflictions preparing glory for us? What are afflictions affecting? because afflictions can't make glory more glorious. Glory already exists. It's already there. So how can afflictions be doing something to the glory? What are afflictions accomplishing? How are they affecting this glory? Well, they aren't making things in heaven better. They're making us better able to enjoy it. Afflictions aren't polishing or multiplying glory. Afflictions are preparing us to better know and experience that glory. I like this illustration. That right there, I know it's not super clear on the screen, but we're going to call that the joy thimble. So that's basically what we have. And afflictions are giving us honker buckets for joy. It's not that afflictions make glory more glorious, it's that afflictions get us ready to contain and hold more of it. And this is where we really got to ask ourselves, well, how much glory do I want? And that's where C.S. Lewis would say that God finds our wants and desires too weak, not too strong, because we're satisfied with the thimbles full rather than honker buckets. Our joy buckets are so small, so easily filled, we're easily satisfied. But in order to know and enjoy the kind of glory that God has for His people, then He's got to increase the size of our thimbles into buckets. It is no pain, no glory. Or at least not in its ultimate degrees. John Bunyan said this in his book, Seasonable Counsel, Advice to Sufferers. He said, "It is the will of God that they that go to heaven should go thither hardly or with difficulty. The righteous shall scarcely be saved. That is, they shall, but with great difficulty, that it may be the sweeter." Now I imagine if a thimble had a mouth. Let's personify our already silly illustration from thimble and bucket. I can easily envision thimble tails rather than veggie tails. And the thimble has a mouth. And I can totally imagine the thimble crying out when it gets shoved into the furnace, into the heat, to be loosened up, brought out, and then hammered, and thinned, and pulled, and stretched again and again. I can envision the thimble complaining about that process, not being super excited to be heated up, smashed, pulled, stretched, reformed, and okay, now I'm the right size. Well, probably not. Can you hold an infinite amount of glory? No. So we all have more of that work to go. If we would enjoy an exceeding, an exaggerated, a hyperbolic weight of glory, then the suffering of this present life prepares us for that. Comparatively, our current afflictions are light and momentary to that eternal and heavy and inexhaustible weight of glory. The third and final consideration is the focus of afflictions. How do we really know that this is happening? How do we know that the inner man is being renewed when everything on the outside argues against good things happening? How do we know that brutal, constant suffering is really for our good? That this isn't some cosmic cruelty to make it hard and then it doesn't get less than hard later? How do we not lose heart? It is by living on unseen things. And that's the remaining part of the paragraph. As we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. This is the money quote of the paragraph, so take this to the bank. This is the fast car, get in and drive it home. This is the key, living on unseen things. We're not looking at the things that are seen. And looking includes more than just coming into our periphery. Looking has the idea of paying attention to. It's the Greek word skopeo. It's watching closely for. Our eyes survey, scan, scope out. And we're not to be fixing our attention on the seen things, but rather the unseen things. Things that are seen, things of this world. And they could be good and bad. It's not just the afflictions that are the seen things. Afflictions and comforts. Any kind of outer man issue. Circumstances, situations, people, problems, clay pot work. Seen things may be sicknesses, bills, broken appliances, recessions and earthquakes. Seen things can also include good things like family, health, resources, paychecks, friendships. But the reason that pilgrims don't look to or depend on seen things is because we know their condition. They're transient. They're temporal. They're passing away. They're impermanent, passing, fleeting, here today and then gone. Seen things are short-term investments. That's why the Apostle John said the world is passing away along with its desires in 1 John chapter 2, verse 17. So Christians look to the things that are unseen. And of course, there's great irony there, right? To look at what you cannot see. To focus on the, in some ways, unfocusable. What you can't see is what we're supposed to be seeing, paying attention to, surveying. So what are these unseen things we're supposed to be paying attention to? One option is our soul. So plural, that would be, as we look to unseen things, we look to souls, our soul and other people's soul. And of course, the soul is unseen and it is important. Peter says, as sojourners and exiles, we must abstain from the passions of the flesh which wage war against our souls. We ought to be sober-minded and watchful for sake of the most important unseen thing in us, which is our souls. I don't think that's what Paul is talking about in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, though. Another possibility would be that we're to look to unseen things being God himself. God is spirit. God is not seen. Paul wrote in 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 17, to the King of ages, immortal, invisible, the only God. The author of Hebrews wrote that Moses left Egypt by faith, not being afraid of the anger of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 27. I think Bunyan himself saw God as the primary unseen thing, even in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 18. If you haven't read it before, his autobiography will both drive you crazy and give you encouragement, titled Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners. In his autobiography, he's talking about the time when he thinks he's about ready to go to prison. And he is getting his emergency plan in order for how he's going to survive that. And he's got a two-step plan to prepare his soul for prison. He said, before I came to prison, I saw what was a coming. I always love that. Now, I want to add a dash to every participle I can think of now, but I saw what was coming and had especially two considerations warm upon my heart. The first was how to be able to endure should my imprisonment be long and tedious, which over a decade of imprisonment counts as long and tedious. The second was to be able to encounter death should that be here my portion. That saying in 2 Corinthians 1:9 was of great use to me, but we had the sentence of death in ourselves, that we should not trust in ourselves, but God which raiseth the dead. By this scripture I was made to see that if I would ever suffer rightly, I must pass a sentence of death upon everything that can properly be called a thing of this life, even to reckon myself, my wife, my children, my health, my enjoyments, and all as dead to me, and myself as dead to them. The second was to live upon God that is invisible. As Paul said in another place, the way not to faint is to look at the things which are seen, not to look at the things that are seen, but at the things that are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. And that is the key to not losing heart. That is the key to staying on the narrow right pilgrim's path and course. That is the key to not being crushed by the difficulties and the hardships, is to live on unseen things. Live on is close to look to. So Bunyan describes it as living on, and Paul describes it as look to the things that are unseen. In Bunyan's case, living on is a way you might describe how you continue to exist. So somebody who's living on coffee and nicotine, that's how they're surviving. That's their primary resources, sustenance, as little as it may be. Living on is similar to look to, and it starts with the invisible God. I just want to point out, not to disagree excessively with Bunyan, I just want to point out, though, that Paul could have said, not looking at the seen things, but looking to the unseen God. And in my mind, that stands out. Because he already wrote about God who was invisible, like I quoted from 1 Timothy chapter 1. So he doesn't say that in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. He says unseen things rather than, I mean, he knew the word for God and Jesus and Lord and all those vocabulary. So he could have said, not the seen things, but looking at the unseen God. He doesn't. That's true. We look at the invisible God, and I'm okay with understanding God as part or even the primary part of unseen things, but I think we can be more precise. I think when Paul says we live on unseen things, he means that we need to live on God's promises. I think that that's ultimately what Paul is referring to. So unseen things equals God's promises. The things that are unseen are eternal, and God is eternal, so he would qualify, but so are his promises. Every word of God is living and abiding and remains forever, according to 1 Peter chapter 1, 23 to 25. And the promises in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 alone are enough to live on. The promised weight of glory is eternal. It's a never-ending timeline sort of promise. He promises a resurrected life that is eternal, contrasted with our mortal flesh that's wasting away. He promises that we'll be brought into God's presence, and that promise is as certain as God's Son is alive. So just in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, we get things like spiritual sight, spiritual life, resurrection, fellowship with Jesus, the weight of glory. None of those are necessarily seen now, but they all last forever. They're all eternal. They are without equal and without end. His promises are everlasting or indelible, unshakable. Over and over again in Bunyan's book, Pilgrim's Progress, Christian, who is the primary character's name, if you haven't read it, I mean, sheesh. You should. And now let me throw in the obligatory, don't read Pilgrim's Progress instead of the Bible. It's not inspired, but stop tweeting and read a book for a little bit. It's good for us. So after your devotions, do the 1 minute a day Pilgrim's Progress reading. You'll finish that in a while. But the key character, Christian, along with his fellow pilgrims, was given glimpses to the celestial city to spur his journey. And maybe the most fantastic and underrated scene in Pilgrim's Progress finds Christian and his friend Hopeful chained by giant despair in the dungeon of Doubting Castle. If I didn't have multiple layers on, you'd be seeing goosebumps. You read? Christian Hopeful chained by giant despair in Doubting Castle. Despair has beaten them almost to death. They feared for their lives. They were tempted to take their lives. And then Christian remembered something. Oh, this is good. This is straight from the Pilgrim's Progress. Now, a little before it was day, good Christian, as one half amazed, break out in this passionate speech. "What a fool," quoth he, "am I, thus to lie in a stinking dungeon when I may as well walk at liberty. I have a key in my bosom called promise that I am persuaded will open any lock in Doubting Castle." Then said Hopeful, "That's good news." "Good brother, pluck it out of thy bosom and try." Then Christian pulled it out of his bosom and began to try at the dungeon door, whose bolt, as he turned the key, gave back, and the door flew open with ease, and Christian and Hopeful both went out. Now, if there was ever a time when a semicolon needs to be red inked out and an exclamation point shoved in, it's, "That's good news." How could Bunyan let that semicolon from Hopeful remain? That's good news, semicolon. Give it a shot. That noise that you hear is Mr. Goosebump knocking at the door. Giant despair can do his worst, but there is a key called promise that unlocks every thick door out of the dungeon and enables our escape. Bunyan knew the importance of promises. In his book, Sighs from Hell, he wrote this, "I tell thee, friend, there are some promises that the Lord hath helped me to lay hold of Jesus Christ through and by, that I would not have out of the Bible for as much gold and silver as can lie between York and London piled up to the stars." And, I mean, can we say that? Or would we be all right with more money in the bank account? I mean, would we really trade promises, God's promises, for some of those sorts of things? Another quote from Bunyan, last one. He said in his book, Come and Welcome to Jesus Christ, "God hath strewed all the way from the gate of hell where thou wast, to the gate of heaven whither thou art going, with flowers out of his own garden. Behold, how the promises, invitations, calls, and encouragements like lilies lie round about thee. Take heed that thou dost not tread them under thy foot." We need to live on unseen things. We need to live on God. We need to pay attention to our soul. But both of those connect as we know and rehearse and share and proclaim the key called promise. God's promises are worth knowing and worth depending on. That's what keeps us from losing heart. The survival of a pilgrim requires that he lives on unseen things. Clay pots will simply do whatever they can to get out of the rotation of being used up, worn out, and beat up. Clay pots want out apart from living on God's promises. We'll lose heart if we don't live on unseen things. One crucial clarification needs to be made, because according to 2 Corinthians chapter 4, afflictions are light and momentary only for those looking and living on unseen things. That is, only for those who believe the gospel promises. There are people in hardship and difficulty whom their momentary afflictions don't compare with the eternal weight of greater suffering and affliction and consequences if they don't believe God's promises. It's only good news. Afflictions are at work for everybody, but they're only making honker buckets to receive joy for those who receive and believe the promises. For pilgrims, though, our pain is but preparation for eternal glory. What hope is in our heavenly home? An unbelievable amount, an inexhaustible, hyperbolic amount. So let's fix our eyes and our hope on the grace that is to be revealed to us at the next advent of Jesus Christ, living on unseen things. Father, help us by your Spirit to do that. Thank you for your word, what treasure it is to us, how great and gracious you are, not only to have fulfilled many of your promises, but to make them so clear they stand out. Our way is strewn along with these promises that you make. And so you love for us to trust you. You love to increase our joy capacity for that coming weight of eternal glory, that we would know it more and our joy would be thick and strong and never ending because it's in you. So give us perspective on our troubles and lift our heads to look to you. Currently unseen, your Son is unseen. We don't see him now, but we love him. We don't see him now, but we rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, waiting for the final salvation of our souls. Come and get us soon. Send your Son. We pray in his name. Amen.